Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, and I'm joined today by Annalisa Morato, one of our therapists, and Dr. Tricia Smith, our clinical director here at the clinic. And today we're going to be talking about loneliness, and the title is actually Loneliness is a Health Crisis. And I guess maybe we should start by actually defining what we mean by loneliness. Is loneliness the same as being alone?
I don't believe so. I think people can feel very alone in a large group of people. I think they can feel alone in their families. I think that they can feel alone even in a small group of really close friends.
So what is loneliness then? I just want to make that distinction. Loneliness is not that what we're talking about here is not the objective being around people or not being around people. You can be around people and still be lonely, correct? Except what is loneliness then? It's a subjective feeling. It's what it is. It's not an objective being. Castaway, the movie, lost on the island all by himself. Okay. That's isolation, forced isolation in that case. But loneliness, as you said, people in community that the people we're talking about are usually in families, in churches, and that yet they feel lonely.
I hear that pretty frequently from my patients. It's like, I have all these people around me, but I feel lonely. So their physical basic needs are being met, but there's just a complete lack of emotional intimacy.
Oh, and I see where you went there. So loneliness is something about an emotional connection. No, intimacy meaning connection, getting to be known, being known, not connecting on some interpersonal level. That's what loneliness, I don't have that connection.
Yeah, being able to give and receive and being seen and heard in a relationship.
Emphasis on the seen and heard.
So say that again.
Emphasis on the part about being seen and heard for who you are. And not feeling judged by someone, but feeling like someone actually gets to see you for who you are.
Yeah, I'm bouncing that idea around in my head. Just first question is that you know exclusive to loneliness, or is that a prime indicator of loneliness? Is that something other than loneliness? I think that's probably the lonely people are gonna identify with what you said. I really do. Not being seen, not being heard, not being connected. Would lonely people struggle with being valued?
Yeah.
Would lonely people struggle with having a sense of worth, you think?
Yeah.
Even if people that you mentioned, they're around people, they don't feel or experience themselves as being seen, heard, valued. Even if maybe some of those people do see, hear, and value them? Is it that it's not actually happening? There's people around me, but they're all off, they're obtuse, dad's got a job, mom's in the, nobody actually has time for me, and it's an objective, in other words, reality-based experience because they are not, is that what we're describing? Or is it that they actually could have people still that actually invest in them, take time for them, concern for them? Express that in healthy ways, and they still feel lonely.
Well, then my question to your question would be, are they actually showing up as who they are, or are they showing up as a role that they feel like they need to play? Because I'll hear patients say, if you only knew me, or if they only knew me, and it's like, well, let us see that side of you.
Okay, like, and so those patients who say that, okay, they would be struggling with loneliness. And then what is the barrier? And their complaint is, I'm not being seen. I'm not being heard. If only people, what was it you said? If only people
knew
me.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, and then the question is, why don't people know you? And you're you know, observations and conclusions because they're not being genuine, not being themselves.
Yeah. Why?
Perhaps it wasn't safe to be themselves, or they didn't have the space to be themselves. So I'm thinking one dynamic is coming to my mind as I'm thinking about a child in a home environment with parents that are self-preoccupied. So they learn fairly early on, I need to be attuned to whatever mom's needs are, what dad's needs are. So they learn that relationships come at a cost. And the cost is, I can't be who I am. I need to be this version of me for that person. So then seeking closeness in relationships moving forward, it's, if you only knew me, you would not want me. But if I can show up a certain way for you, then we can have this closeness. It's unfortunate and it's distorted, and I recognize that, but it's typically this long pattern of feeling like they haven't had the space to be who they are, and then questioning, who am I? If I'm not the supportive person, if I'm not the caring person, if I'm not carrying the weight for the family, then who am I?
So you did not describe what we would call overt abuse. Mm-hmm. You really described kind of a emotional neglect of a sort. Not that they were not fed or clothed or housed, but there was no interest shown in their heart, mm-hmm. thoughts, dreams, actions. That's what you described. Am I so far correct?
That's right.
And so the child adapts to that because what's the child seeking?
Connection.
Okay. So the child seeks to get a connection by
playing a role,
performing. Yeah, there we go.
Performing mm-hmm. to get validation or praise, to get yeah. some attention, yeah. some time. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I would also say that, giving that example, I think a lot about our society today and how social media plays such a role in
I want to go into social media yet. Okay. Okay. No, that's it. No, we need to go to social media. Mm-hmm. But I think these early developmental stuff needs maybe some so don't feel like you just got smacked down because you weren't, because that's really good.
But we
actually need to go to social media. But these you know, this loneliness business, mm-hmm. what you're describing is an identity formation. And where does identity form? Sense of self form, early parent relationships. So one would be this lack of affirming. Mm-hmm. And so the parents did not affirm, didn't say, we love you for who you are, in not just words, but actions, deeds, showing that interest. So they didn't get that internalization that they mattered. So they didn't form a connection, potentially. Seems to me they were forming a connection based on performance rather than identity or who they are. But then there's the trauma experience as well, which is different, where the children are actually exploited, abused in some way, beaten up or molested or exploited, and what they learn is what relationships are not safe. It's not that I have to take a role to actually have a connection. Mm-hmm. It's that relationships are not safe. The people that I trust hurt me. Mm-hmm. I can't trust. I can't make a connection, because the moment you connect with the people that mm-hmm. that are supposed to be there, they'll hurt you. So you have to stay guarded. You have to, you know, if you connect, it has to be on a pretense. It has to be behind a mask. It has to be in some other structure, because if you really connect to your true self, you're going to get exploited, taken advantage of, hurt, burned, traumatized in some way. And so they also, you know, and they wear masks for a variety of reasons. One is self-protection. One is kids that have been abused will have distorted self-image, feel inadequate, feel often ugly or dirty or bad. And if anybody knew me, they wouldn't like me. And so they wear the mask to be liked. But then when they're liked for the pretense that they put, mm-hmm. it doesn't count, because that's not really who I am. So they always feel disconnected or lonely. And so they're looking for a genuine person to see them for who they are and still like them. Is this fair?
This is fair. And I want to add to that as well. What I've been seeing with some of the patients that I work with is they're competent. And from the outside looking in, they have all the things going for them. Great career. They have a family, but they still feel deeply lonely. And what's happening in early childhood is, I don't have that person that's emotionally attuned to me. So the goal is I need to be self-sufficient.
Yeah, so we've identified the inattentive, mm-hmm. we've identified the abusive. Mm-hmm. Back to the question though, can people feel lonely when they actually have people who care about them?
I do, yeah.
So it's okay, but maybe mm-hmm. that's downstream from these initial setups.
Okay. Experience.
Yeah. Okay. Are we making the case? Are we making an argument that if somebody struggles with chronic loneliness, we're saying it's because something failed to develop in a healthy way in their upbringing, in them. Something interfered with healthy development. That if they developed a healthy internal sense of self, they wouldn't be feeling lonely. Are we saying that it's always going to be a symptom of an internal work or healing? There's maybe a wound they haven't actually addressed yet. Or are we saying a perfectly, maybe perfect's the wrong word, a mature, healthy human being can still struggle with loneliness?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm taking the position it's always an evidence of some pathology. Always. Now, that pathology could be mm-hmm. grief. A spouse has died and you have deep loneliness, but you didn't before. But that deep loneliness is an evidence of pathology. You've lost something and you've got a deep emotional wound now. Give me a scenario where deep loneliness is not related to some wound, some pathology, some injury, something that's amiss. I can't think of one.
So I was going down the route of social media because I think that a lot of our teenagers, our young adults, have grown up in a society where the answers are at their fingertips. They're connected to so many people, but they're not necessarily connected in those intimate, deep relationships. They're often putting on, in these video games, different facades mm-hmm. or different filters on their cameras or putting on these different faces as they are coming into themselves. As they are learning into themselves. Are they that mature adult that they've gotten there yet? No, but they're in the developmental phase. And I think as they're in the developmental phase and how they're getting so influenced into these comparisons and social media and trying to keep up with their peers or who they're supposed to be or not supposed to be and how they're trying to find themselves, I think at times loneliness hits them in trying to figure out who they are in this world that is being inundated with all of these images and media and who they're supposed to be and how they're supposed to grow and trying to figure out who they are.
And so are you saying what you just described? Are you saying that is not or is evidence of pathology? Because my premise is if you struggle with deep loneliness, it's an evidence of an internal wound, injury, pathology, brokenness, something that in that person needs healing. Because loneliness is not about being alone. It's an internal. That's what I'm saying. And so I thought there was a disagreement. No, we could have loneliness and not have any internal wounds. And then, so is this about the social media a suggestion? Because my view is what you described was injury. What's happening with social media mm-hmm. is inflicting injury. It's harming. That's why they're experiencing the loneliness. So I heard your description as validating my premise because social media pretends in an artificial way to have connection while it actually has no intimacy. It has no real connection. It's all artificial. And so it actually steals or robs the individual developing ego, self, person from forming real connections where they're actually known. And so it inflames the insecurity, the fear, the isolation because they put these multiple expectations fantasy. Superficial connections with no real being known or being seen. And so it inflames that and creates this wound and sense of isolation and loneliness. So to me, that argues for my point. Had they not had social media and coming through a healthy home and not engaged in what you described, they wouldn't end up feeling all this loneliness. Yeah. So again, back to loneliness, I'm going to say, if you're listening, you struggle with deep loneliness, it's an indicator in the same way if you're struggling with fever. If you got a high fever of 104, okay, you're not a bad person. You're not an evil person. That fever is telling you, hey, there's something wrong. Let's find out what it is and let's address it. You get deep loneliness, you're not a bad person, but it's telling you there's something that needs addressing, something that needs healing. Because loneliness is not about being alone. There's something that's interfering with your ability to connect with others.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, the people in the spectrum, the autistic spectrum, they often isolate. They don't feel alone. They don't have loneliness feelings. They're actually content. There are people that have certain personality structures that prefer the classic hermit in history. They don't feel alone. They don't feel lonely. They don't have that problem. Okay. So the deep lonely longing and dissatisfaction. So the solution for deep loneliness is identifying the cause. Like if you have a high fever, what's the solution for high fever? Tylenol? No, that's not the solution for high fever. This is for high fever. That might mitigate for a few hours and bring the temperature down. It doesn't solve why you have the fever. And so the solution for deep loneliness is not what a lot of people end up doing. These transient, pick somebody up, have a night of connection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Social media likes. Okay. Give you a momentary, I feel something. Okay. That's like the Tylenol. It doesn't fix anything. The solution is to do some introspection. And where's this coming from? Is it that, I always felt I had to perform. I never felt valued for me. Okay. Who am I? Where does my real value come from? I'm afraid because I've been burned. I've gotten abused. I trusted people every time I've gotten taken advantage of, and it's not safe to connect. That's a different solution. Is this?
No,
you think I'm being reasonable or unreasonable? And is this in this conversation?
No, I think you're being reasonable.
You think I'm saying it in a way that the listener might feel like we're labeling them or demeaning them, calling them pathological. Because I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to, in the same way, again, somebody has a fever. I'm not saying, oh, you're bad. I'm saying, hey, it's a symptom. There's something, and we can treat it.
To the core.
Yeah, I want people to hear hope from this.
It's loneliness is subjective and it's vague. So even as we're trying to define it here, I'm sure that there are going to be some viewers that are like, that captures part of my experience, but it doesn't capture the entire experience for me.
Yeah, do you have any thoughts on, I agree with you. Any elements that you on your mind that we might want to add in to capture a wider experience, or we'll just keep our mind open to that possibility.
So I know that I hear a lot from patients or clients that, you know, the holidays are specifically lonely for a lot of people. Some of it may be grief, loss of a loved one, and this is the first holiday that they are going without that partner. Some of it is family dysfunction, mm-hmm. where going into family settings can be very hard in nature for some people, or even if they don't want to put themselves inside that dynamics, they may stay away from family dynamics during the holidays, which makes it extra lonely. Or the single person who wished that they had a partner during that time and having to go through the holidays alone. So it brings up these feelings of loneliness and not being with somebody.
Two things. If I forget the single person, bring me back to that. This is an important caveat we need to flesh out from the other. But why do you think it is the holidays bring this to greater awareness or magnification? Now, the holidays causing, my point is that the holidays are causal. Holidays cause loneliness. Is that what we're saying? 100% not.
That's where she's going.
No. I want people to understand that. The holidays are not causing loneliness. No. Holidays bring to one's attention the importance of relationship and connection, mm-hmm. and often push a pause on the mm-hmm. business of life. Mm-hmm. And people who are lonely, but otherwise maybe quite functional, professional, will often be distracted from their loneliness by their career pursuits or other activities. The holidays make it harder to distract themselves from it. So it brings it greater to attention. So you're right. Many people will struggle during the holiday time, because but the holidays didn't create it. Mm-hmm. It's an underlying element that they struggle with. But I want to talk about the single person, because there's an aspect of the single person that could misidentify loneliness, and that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about this loneliness that's a chronic. But in Eden, God created Adam in sinless world in perfection. It is not good for man to be alone. He has created us for intimacy and connection. And a healthy, mature person without a deep wound will often have a longing for that intimate marital connection. And they're not quite satisfied without it. That is not pathology. Okay? And people need to recognize that is not loneliness either. Because those people can be, have a deep friendship, be very connected, feel seen and understood by their family and friends, but they still have that aspect of their created being that has not been fulfilled in the way God designed it. And that's what they're missing there. It's not pathology as in brokenness, woundedness, injury. It is incompleteness in the calling that God created us for. And that needs to be set aside as something different than the loneliness coming out of what we describe, neglect, abuse, and so forth.
Would you describe that as grief of what could have been or what should have been, or a grief over that future narrative?
No. And I want to come back to that question, but I also want to say that the people who come out of the trauma, out of the neglect, who have real loneliness, will often seek to cure their loneliness through the intimate marriage relationship, finding that intimate relationship, because there is a certain approximation of the feeling, a longing for someone, but it never works. If you go into a marriage relationship because you have broken woundedness and you're lonely and empty, okay, then you're trying to get the marriage partner to fix something that God never intended them to fix. They cannot fix for you. And these relationships usually devolve into codependent and mesh-controlled relationships that become dysfunctional, and they actually make matters worse, that inflames the fears and insecurities in the one who is seeking. So it's a real important thing, to make that distinction in one's own heart. Am I simply longing for the connection and intimate experience God designed us to have in marriage? Or is there emptiness, brokenness, woundedness inside that I'm hoping, dreaming, wishing, longing, and mixing those two desires, expecting that I will be completed and whole and these wounds will be gone in that marriage? And I think that's a big distinction to make. Now, what was the other thing I got off you mentioned?
Oh, I was asking, would you describe it as grief of what could have been, what should have been, a future narrative that you had in your mind for your life?
So, no. Can you grieve something you've never had? Grief is the process of resolving loss. You've had to lose something in order to grieve it, if you haven't actually ever attached to it or had it. So this, so in my view, you're talking about the marriage relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're alive, why are you grieving? You just haven't found yet. I've known people who've gotten married for the first time, of people who've gotten married the first time, 70, 80, 90. Okay?
Yeah.
They didn't lose something, they just hadn't found it yet.
Yeah.
And so for me, if you go down the grief trail, that means you have decided, you've given up. You're not actually still open and pursuing the path of looking and opening for where God will bring that person into your life. Where is it said if you're not married by 25, then you need to start grieving? You're not married by 35, you need to start grieving. You're not married by 45, you need to start grieving. I don't understand that question.
So, I mean, I would
I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you, but because my mind just jumped on it, because I get this from our patients a lot, where therapists will tell them they need to grieve something that they never actually had.
They never had?
Right. Like you need to grieve the college you never went to. Your friends went to college, you didn't. You need to grieve that. No, you don't. That's not grief. That's a different process.
I agree with that.
Yeah. So I think the grief label gets mislabeled. Now, there can be a grief grieving a dream. You had your heart, you had a dream, you had an aspiration, and that was your goal, and now you have to let that go. You were working to be an Olympic athlete, and you got in an art car accident, and now you've got an injury. Well, you're actually not just grieving the dream, you're grieving the loss of your health, and you actually had your health, now you lost it. Okay.
And that's pretty common that I see that.
Yes, actually. But you've lost something there that you had. Okay, I'm sorry, interrupt you.
Well, so, I mean, this conversation probably going down a different path, but, I mean, during the holidays, single people are inundated with the Hallmark Channel, jewelry for presents, all of these type of moments that are wrapped around family and being with a person. I don't know about necessarily grieving not having that, but being lonely, being sad, not having that opportunity to experience that with somebody who you may have had experiences in previous relationships where that was a nice experience, that was something that you enjoyed, that is something that you want or long for, as you have said. And that experience, I think, during the holidays is what brings kind of those lower feelings or that down kind of loneliness during that time of that wanting that either marital comfort or that relationship or being able to bring somebody home for the holidays or doing those types of ice skating or hot chocolate during all those times that Hallmark has said is wonderful and what you're supposed to be doing during the holidays.
Yeah, so maybe the problem there is watching Hallmark Channel, but
what about Valentine's Day?
It's not seriously, but the issue at hand. Anybody in those circumstances struggling with those emotional some type of a distressing or dysphoric way. First question: dive into your heart. Ask the Holy Spirit to lead you. Am I lonely? Is there a wound, something broken in me that needs healing? Am I not lonely and I'm just having a longing for the connection that you designed for me to have, Lord? There needs to be diagnostic differentiation there. If the longing, if there's really not loneliness, no, I'm not lonely. I'm actually quite at peace with myself. I just really would love that relationship. If that's the answer, then you actually, Lord, I'm going to trust you with this. I really believe you can see the future I can't see. You have a plan for me that is better than the plan that I have for me. I want that connection, Lord. Now, I will tell you my own life journey. I had these very experiences when I was single. And I remember for a period of years, actually, when I was less mature, praying, Lord, help me find the right one. Help me find the right one. Help me find the right one. And then the Lord kept working with me. And then I finally matured enough that my prayer switched. And I said, Lord, help me become the right man for the woman you would have for me. And I met my wife 3 months later. Seriously. He was waiting for me to actually realize I had to have a certain mindset and maturity, be able to be successful in the role of a husband. And just desiring a spouse didn't mean I was prepared to be a spouse. And so my point being is what you described might very well be part of the therapeutic process as they have those experiences, the holiday, they make them dissatisfied with their current state. They might find themselves where I was, where they need to do a little reflection and a little prayer and a little reorientation of their priorities. And then ultimately, trust God when that timing is right. impact of loneliness on development. Let's talk with adults now because we don't do kids here. Okay. So adults who have chronic loneliness, what if they're not actually resolving it in a healthy way, what does that often result in how they function and where does it take them? Chronic loneliness, where does it take them? How does it impact them? What have you seen?
Isolation, depression, low self-worth.
Okay. So one possibility, isolation, depression, low self-worth. Others?
Difficulty functioning, daily life,
negative substances.
Substances to escape.
Okay. I mean, isn't that a common theme in people with substance issues? They have chronic emptiness and loneliness, and they're trying to medicate that away and not feel it. How about connections with pathological people? In other words, they're lonely, and so they find hangouts, groups of people, so they don't have to be alone. But they're not actually making real connections of a healthy kind. Mm-hmm. For instance, people who have addictions may have their drinking buddies,
mm-hmm.
as an example, or their token buddies.
Yeah.
Okay. Or have you seen lonely people who have had more intimate physical relationships? Lots and lots of physical pickups. Yeah. I mean, isn't this a classic, a lonely person's certain types of expressions of loneliness get expressed through going to bars and looking for a pickup?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, and then how about that insecure attachment, codependent relationship seeking to get, you know, their loneliness resolved by an attachment?
Yeah, and all of those with addictions, with seeking out attention at bars, or those quick hiccups, or those Netflix and nights, those quick connections always lead to the guilt and shame, which then leads into the loneliness and the depression, and it just cycles, and they continue to have these engagements, which leads to those continued feelings and this building of shame.
What do you think the primary mode emotional driver for loneliness is? Is it love? What would the lonely person say, though, they're pursuing? What do they want? Don't they all say they want to be loved? Don't they think they're on the love trail? But are they actually motivated by love?
That's a good question.
Are they? What is the, I mean, I'm pretty clear no.
Mm-hmm.
What's the primary motivator of the lonely person? Maybe we should define what love is here.
Yeah.
Is love the motive of, you know, erotic arousal? Of momentary pleasure? No. Love is that altruistic regard or care in uplifting and benefiting another, and the joy and happiness you experience in seeing the other person thriving, being blessed through your investment, through the expenditure of your energy. Your concern is seeing the smile on that person's face for their happiness,
yeah.
not for your validation. See, one of the things that happens is people in the lonely sphere will do things for others as a means to get something back for themselves. You like me?
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate you so much. And they feel good, but they actually, and they think that, but that wasn't love. It wasn't actually for the person. It was for the response. Do you see the difference?
Yeah.
Okay. So the primary driver, in my view, of the lonely person is fear.
Fear of rejection,
fear of loneliness, fear of abandonment, fear of not being liked, fear of inadequacy, fear of rejection, fear of lots of insecurities and fears are the driver, and they're offsetting. They're wanting a connection, and this is and so they want the connection because they don't want to be afraid, they don't want to be alone, they want to be valued, they want to be special, they want to connect, but because it's primarily driven by fear, not actually concern for the other person, their fear causes them to present themselves in what they believe the other person will value, what the other person will appreciate. And as they approach the other person and get validation because they're working really hard, it doesn't count. You don't know me. I'm not seen if you really knew. And then they live in fear, and that only inflames the fear, actually. So they have that momentary appreciation of, we had a great night, it was fun, whatever. Thank you for spending time with me, that's great. But it only makes the fear go up, not down, because they weren't being themselves, they weren't being genuine. And now the fear is, well, if they really saw me, they wouldn't like me. Have you seen this dynamic?
Yeah, I have.
Whereas genuine love is, my investment in you, my time in you, is not so that you'll like me. My time is because I like you. And if you don't want to spend time with me in my presence, if you actually love somebody and they tell you your presence is unpleasant for them, okay, well, I'd love to spend time with you, but I don't want my presence to be torture. That's exactly how God is. God wants to be in our lives. He loves us. But the people who say, I don't want you in my life, Lord, he gives you space. Isn't that right?
Yeah. But that was also comes from a very secure person.
Right. This is my point.
Yes.
Yes. And then what happens is the insecure, lonely person who seeks for this reason puts on the, and they often, sometimes it's conscious. I know he likes this football team. I hate him, but I'm going to wear the jersey anyway. Okay. but most of the time it's unconscious. They don't really realize how much they're adapting to be what that person wants them to be. But it only inflames their fear and insecurity. And as the fear and insecurity goes up, they become more desperate, if you will, more needy, more controlling, more monitoring, more hypervigilant, less secure, and it spirals.
So it's important to, what I'm hearing you say, it's important to start with the person, start with yourself, because we're talking about love and we're talking about fear. Loving someone when you don't even love yourself.
Interesting. That's a very interesting insight. Can somebody... What did you say? Love your neighbor as yourself. You actually can't love somebody if you don't have healthy love for yourself, which you can't have if you don't have a connection with the God of love. Did you all disagree with that idea? And there's a connection with the God of love that brings that internal, what the Bible calls it, rebirth experience, new heart rate spirit, that inner peace, that actual validation, that love, is that connection the same thing as joining a church? Is that connection the same thing as believing in Jesus Christ?
It's more than believing.
Don't the devils believe and tremble?
Yeah.
Okay. This is my point. There's a way to cognitively acknowledge and have the belief in God without having an actual intimate connection with him, not having the renewed heart and relationship, not having that rebirth experience. And so there are many fearful Christians with broken relationships, and they don't understand why. Why? I accept Jesus. I was baptized. I go to church. I pay my tithe. Why? Why? Have you actually opened the heart and trust and moved away from a fear-based life pattern to a love God and other life pattern? And the fear-based life pattern will ultimately, in the religious worlds, typically evolve around rules. There'll be a rule, law, order, structure, makes you feel safe.
Yeah. And I see that here, even with our patients, they'll have sessions with you, or they're in group with you, or Pastor Vames, and they're like, my perception of God has been challenged in the best way. And I'm like, what was your relationship like before? And it was based on rules, very legalistic, punishment focused.
So think about a relationship like that. Think about a, I wish I had the whole little scenario. A friend of mine wrote out a scenario to kind of depict this, a marriage relationship in which a woman meets her man, okay? And he takes her out to dinner, opens the door for her, treats her very nicely, and spends money on her, and then proposes, and she's thrilled, and they get married, and they have a wonderful honeymoon. And the first day back from the honeymoon, 5 a.m., the lights blare on. The Herman walks in and says, the honeymoon's over. Now it's time to get to business. And he hands her the first of many two-week lists that has an itemized list of all of her duties and responsibilities that she has to fulfill at 6 o'clock in the morning. Get up and begin breakfast while Hermie cuddles and takes care of his shower. At 6:30, meet him at the door with his coat. And then his long list of all the duties. And when he comes home, have his bath drawn for him. And this long list of duties that she has to do. And the years are dragging by, and they were dragging.
Sure.
Okay. And it was just, I mean, it's a long description of all this required duties that she must do. And then suddenly one day he has a heart attack and dies. And relief. And she's never going to get married again. But a few years go by, and she meets a gentleman named Michael. And he takes her out and dinner, and opens the door, treats her kindly and thoughtful. And she's thinking, no, mm-hmm. no. But he proposes, and she says, yes. And beautiful honeymoon. And the first day after the honeymoon, the light comes on early in the morning. And he walks in, and she jumps up the karate stance and rips the paper out of his hand and tears it up. And he goes, that was a poem I just wrote for you, and I've fixed breakfast to bring you in bed. and completely different. And then he spends his time seeking to always build her up and uplift her. And a few years go by, and she's cleaning out the attic, and she finds this boxes of lists of all the things she had to do. And she opens one and with the previous husband, mm-hmm. and she's going through the list of cooking dinner and cleaning the house and doing all this. She realizes she's been doing all of this for Michael, and it never seemed like work. You see, and this story depicts the fear-based, rules-oriented approach versus the love
expectation.
The love, because I love, I want to do these things approach. Okay, it's a really cool story that depicts these things. But this goes back to that loneliness person. The loneliness person is not wrong to want connection. That's a God-given desire. But if they've had wounds they haven't healed, then they may pursue relationships to provide or do something that God never intended the relationship to do, and he can't do. And in other words, provide need, internal identity. Your relationship with your spouse cannot define who you are. You can't find your worth in your marriage. You can't find your identity in your marriage. That actually comes from the Lord. Is that not true?
Yeah.
And so you have to have that connection, heal that, and then love the Lord and have godly love for who you are, valued child of his. And that enables you to go out and engage in loving relationship. Is that fair? So what practical steps can we, suggest to our listeners if they're struggling with loneliness? What were practical steps to help them, be able to resolve that?
So I think you touched on, some childhood stuff that may need to be identified and picked apart if it is an attachment wound that may need to be worked through therapy. I think you've identified some self identification and relationship with God. So if there's some internal confidence, internal awareness, identifying of self that can be worked through therapy, and then maybe even having time with God and finding your identity through God are all different steps that you can take to help and then create those connections mm-hmm. with others, those healthy connections.
So appreciate exactly what you said. Mm-hmm. When I kind of boil it down for our audience, what you just described was, if you find yourself struggling with this, first step is diagnosis. You may not use that terminology, but the first step is I'm feeling lonely. Let me prayerfully do introspection to identify why. Is it actual loneliness from wounds and something not having developed in the healthiest of ways within me that needs healing and development? Or is it, that what I'm actually feeling is just the longing for that intimate connection that God built into us, okay? That diagnostic approach. If it's real loneliness, fear-based emptiness, then the next step is from where, why, what's it about? And if you can't figure it out on your own, but you realize it's there and it's really interfering and it's hard, get a professional counselor. And I would, a Christian counselor, somebody that can help you do so. And the goal of a Christian, counselor is not to reach inside you and fix you. They don't fix you. We function very much like a mirror. When you look in a mirror, the mirror gives you feedback that you can't see yourself. Mirror doesn't change anything. You look in the mirror and see dirt on your face. You might be, in a movie production as a mechanic, and you want that dirt right there. That's where it's supposed to be for the scene. Okay, you see feedback, and somebody's showing that you might say, "I love that about me. I'm going to keep that." Mm-hmm. Okay, fine, that's your choice. But the goal of the therapist is to help you see both elements in yourself that you're not able to identify, potential connections and causes and options on, but then at the end of the day, you're making, you'll be making the choices to make changes. Therapist doesn't change anybody. Would you all agree with that?
Agree.
Yeah. And so I would tell you, that would be a step to do to get a therapist if you actually have this deep loneliness that you can't resolve on your own. You know, our website, comeandreason.com, if somebody's struggling with this kind of enmeshed codependent type relationship, we have a resource, you know, codependency, breaking the dependency cycle, little pamphlet. It's free. We ship anywhere in the United States, U.S. postal address, but they can download a PDF from our website. And that's just a little short pamphlet that has steps people can take. Little test inside, test my relationship. Is it a healthy love relationship? Is it a fear-based, codependent, and mesh relationship? And then some steps that you can take to actually begin applying principles that could be healing to your heart and your relationship.
Yeah. I got a question for some of our viewers that are interested in the brain, the neuro piece. Are there actual changes in the brain when someone's deeply lonely?
So I haven't actually seen studies that looked exactly. So loneliness leads to a cascade, and that can lead into depression. Loneliness when people are lonely, but see, is it isolated to loneliness? So anything that makes a person feel anxious or fearful activates amygdala, your fear circuitry. If it's not resolved, that can actually cause looping, you know, ruminating, where you actually disrupt salience. It's a different network, and you actually can reinforce through false conclusions or false beliefs, the fear-based thinking, which causes this ruminating, you know, I'm no good, I'll never be loved, no one will ever like me, ruminating, looping, so that circuit can become disrupted. That can activate your immune system, increasing inflammation, which reacts back upon the brain, causing further brain changes consistent with depression. Can loneliness, absolutely, loneliness can do that. But loneliness, again, is the emotional symptom, in my view, of some other thing that we've been talking about. It's like the fever, okay, that is letting you know something. So loneliness is a symptom that lets you know something's off, and then to identify what it is. And yes, the brain circuits, if you're actually chronically lonely, you're probably chronically fearful and insecure, which probably has a disrupted salience network with ruminating negative loops. And then you interpret things in ways, neutral things in the world, because you're looping in a negative cycle. You will probably often then interpret events in ways that are not helpful to the self, more self-critical, which then can lead to more isolation because of loneliness and fear of rejection and this type of thing. So yeah, circuits can be disrupted. Does that make sense? But you know, part of that is not coming, again, I don't think that's coming from the feeling of loneliness. I think the feeling of loneliness is coming because those things are disrupted, and you've had certain patterns and expectations that have been learned from what we described earlier.
That makes sense.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Spiritual practices that could help?
Being intentional and spending time with God.
Okay, so contemplative meditation. In other words, focusing on some aspect of God's reality, scripture, creation, God's revelations that are bigger than you, in a humble invitation of the Holy Spirit to enlighten you in this process, but a reflective contemplation draws your mind away from self. The lonely person often gets looping on self. And they may not notice it because they may be thinking, they're not thinking about self, they're thinking about other people. I'm thinking about my husband, I'm thinking about my wife, I'm thinking about the kids in school. But if you actually have them describe what they're thinking about what other people are thinking of them. They're thinking about whether they'll be liked or not. They're thinking about whether they'll be accepted, whether they'll be rejected, whether they'll connect, whether they'll be embarrassed. So they're actually not thinking about the other people. They're thinking about what the other people think of them. Does that make sense? Okay. The contemplation aspects draws your mind outward, thinking actually about God. And the goal here is to reflect deeply in a contemplative conversation with the Lord about His whatever it is your passage of scripture, whatever, what is the meaning there? What is the truth? What is the revelation God is would have for you from that? And then what application does that have to your life? You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, and then the power of choice. Choice to believe, choice to act. Change doesn't actually come from new insights alone. My residency, they told us, insight does not equal change.
Mm-hmm.
Insight is often necessary for change, often, not always. But insight does not equal, people can have an awareness and still not change. And so if you have an awareness that there is a change that needs, I really do need to change this. I need to, this relationship I'm in, he's cheated on me for 11 times over the last 11 days. Okay, whatever. But you know what I'm talking about. We have patients that come all the time and they will give you a history. They have clear insight. This is a toxic relationship. But they don't make a decision in governance of self to end it. They don't. They know it's killing them, but they stay. The addict with their addiction. Mm-hmm. Many of them will come. They know, but they don't. And then, of course, the step coming here is their initial now step to finally change. But this has been going on a long time. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the question would be, okay, is there truths, awarenesses, insights that you actually know you're ignoring? Mm-hmm. Yes, the Holy Spirit about that. And what choice do you have? Choice to understand. Choice to believe not just your mind, but with your heart. What are you going to value in your heart? And then what action do you want to take? That's how actual transformation happens. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah. And then being willing to tolerate the discomfort. You know, one of the truisms I tell our team, once there is woundedness or brokenness of any kind,
there's no pain-free options.
That's right. There's no pain-free options. Only option is to heal or not heal. And sadly, many people that have this kind of brokenness, they're actually moment to moment looking for what feels best, what comforts most, not what actually is best. And so the Jesus said, you know the truth and the truth will set you free. Mm-hmm. So having that mind that's looking to the Lord, mm-hmm. fixing your eyes upon him, seeking his truth applicable to your life. Mm-hmm. There's lots of truths. I mean, there's truths about, you know, mathematical principles. That's probably not the truth you need to be focusing on. Mm-hmm. It's the truth applicable to your life. And as you're focusing on those truths and then applying them step by step, you will heal, but you will necessarily go through some discomfort as you have to let go of some of the things that were comforting you, that were, you know, the alcoholic has to let go of the alcohol. The codependent has to let go of the abusive spouse. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, anything else you guys want to share on the issue of loneliness? Because I have one more idea I want to differentiate, but...
I just had a question for both of you, actually, because you both take a different approach with patients. You're both different people. If you have a patient that's saying to you, oh, I have no motivation, I have no drive, could you briefly both give an example of how you'd respond to that? Because I'm sure the way you're going to respond is going to work really well for some of our viewers, and the way Dr. Smith responds will resonate with others.
I mean, so I would obviously ask a lot of questions around what happened before the unmotivation, mm-hmm. What goals and aspirations do you have, mm-hmm. what's not working. Also try and find out family dynamics as pieces of that. Find out if there's any genetic pieces or medication, chemical things that might need to be changed. There also may be some biological things that obviously at Honey Lake Clinic, we look holistically at the patient. So is there anything spiritual that's causing them to be unmotivated? Is there anything physically mm-hmm. that they're not getting in their system that they need to get into their system to help give them more energy or motivation? Was there hurts or hangups from the past, from their childhood, that maybe they had a life incident come up? Maybe they had a birth of a child and now biologically they've changed, or some things have come up from childhood because of that birth of child, or they're feeling very overwhelmed in their current incident and life experience, so they don't have that motivation. Well, what are some things that we can do to take steps to get more focused in their life and let go of some of the demands that they're experiencing? So I probably ask a lot of questions to gain more understanding of what is some of the roots or what is causing some of those experiences or feelings.
I agree with everything she said. My answer was going to be, lack of motivation is a symptom of what? We have to diagnose. You ask, how do I intervene? Don't intervene until I diagnose. And that's what she just did. She went through a long list of questions because she's trying to differentiate, okay, a motivation. Okay, why? Okay, what's the cause? Long list of symptoms, physiological, spiritual, psychological. Is it actually lack of motivation? Okay, you know, or is the lack of motivation a psychological defense against dealing with something that needs to be dealt with that they are avoiding? And so, but you can't get there just because they say, I'm not motivated. You actually have to do exactly what Dr. Smith said. Lots of questions to help differentiate and diagnose your understanding of what this symptom is coming from. And then you intervene appropriately to the underlying reason they have the symptom. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in closing, I'm just going to differentiate or just add the away from loneliness to social distancing, which can inflame loneliness. But the idea of social distancing, multiple large population studies over decades demonstrate if you socially isolate or distance, you worsen mental health across the board, you shorten lifespan, you worsen your immune system, you increase your risk of viral infections. Okay, think this through. There's no health benefits that have ever been measured from social distancing and social isolation. The only time that's actually appropriate is very transiently for a very short period of time, usually days, no more than a week to 10 days, when somebody is identified to have a communicable disease, the person infected can be put in quarantine for a brief period of time, and that's it. That only prevents the communicable disease from spreading. But when you put a population in social isolation, all health measures get worse. Nothing gets benefited. And this has been well documented coming out of the whole COVID experience, that all of those measures done worsened health across the board. Addictions went up. The depressions went up. Life expectancies went down. Nothing was benefited by that, including nothing such as avoiding the spread and people not getting infected with the disease. So I want people to realize that health, we are socially dynamic beings created for social connection, and it goes against the actual fabric of our being to be forcibly isolated, and it's actually harmful to us. All right. Hope this program was helpful to you. If you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you again next time. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.